drums.
Scene Radio Talk Show.
Welcome to episode 10 of The Arts, The Art Scene Radio Talk Show. I'm your host, Radman.
And I'm Alcavar.
Today's date is Saturday, January 29th, 2005. Thank you, Alcavar, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
This episode, we're going to be discussing a number of related subjects. First, we're going to be talking about podcasting and RSS news feeds, covering current events and recent software releases, and featuring interviews and discussions with alternative media mogul Kizzle, operator of the hacker radio portal hackermedia.net. We'll also be interviewing Sir Garbage Truck, one of the sceners behind the scenes who operates Nectarine Radio. And lastly, Deathbase of the now late Havoc Radio, the first radio show for the demo scene. But first we have an email here from Saul of TMDC, which reads...
Howdy! TMDC 7 is over, and I've promised to organize at least one more. We'll see what happens after that. I think the level of quality has moved in the correct direction. Anyway, I was chatting with some of the competitors on IRC, and someone mentioned your seminar at Assembly, and I just realized I never watched it. Well, I just watched it. Impressive. Very impressive. Thanks for the great seminar. And that's from Saul, the organizer of the Text Mode Demo Contest.
Thank you very much, Saul. While on the subject of the Art of Text Mode seminar video, which was filmed at Assembly 2004, I wanted to just put out a quick disclaimer there, because that was the first time I had given that particular presentation. And early on into that seminar, I stated that Samuel Morse was the first person to introduce the teletype in 1855. That statement is incorrect. Unfortunately, that is a mistruth, I guess you could say, that's perpetuated by alternative historians out there on the internet. So in actual point of fact, the very first teletypes, known as the Morecambe Telegraph Typewheel Page Printers, weren't invented until the early 1900s, circa 1910 or so. So, I just wanted to put that out there to let people know, so they're not repeating the wrong facts there. But on the bright side, since that presentation has been delivered, there have been several discoveries made. First of all, the stone swan, which featured ancient Roman Latin text carved into the shape of a swan, has been partially identified. The poetic text which you see there was actually written by the ancient Roman Latin prose stylist Marcus Tullius Cicero. So we've been able to nail down who created the text that forms the shape of the swan, but we're still trying to positively identify the actual artist who engraved the stone artwork. So I've talked to a few people that study Latin. I've had a couple of people say that the artist may have been named Fjornin, but we're still not completely sure. If anybody who's listening has any friends out there who are PhDs in ancient Roman Latin history, please point them in our direction. Secondly, we've also been contacted by Dr. Jim Mitch, who established the Paul Smith Foundation. And so in that presentation, we show a couple pieces of artwork which were created by a person named Paul Smith, who is an amazing typewriter artist who was born with cerebral palsy. So during the seminar, I talk about the fact that, this particular typewriter artist had cerebral palsy. The only way he could communicate was through the typewriter, and he actually drafted up blueprint designs and instructions on how he wanted his desk to be laid out and his office basically set up. And so Dr. Mitch contacted me, and he's going to be supplying me with photographs of that desk configuration and those blueprints sometime in the future. So perhaps that material can be incorporated into a future presentation sometime down the road.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that really is amazing. It's a really cool story.
It goes to show that regardless of your handicap, you can always overcome it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Dr. Mitch also emailed me late last night just to notify me that there have been some videos posted recently about Paul Smith, which were originally aired in 1988 on ABC television. So they're just really quick clips, but if you wanted to check them out, unfortunately they're low resolution, low bandwidth quality QuickTime videos, but you can still check these out at his website, the Paul Smith Foundation website, which is www.paulsmithfoundation.org/main_video.html.
I found something funny on the internet last night.
Yeah.
Speaking of ancient stuff, there's an old coin that they found in the 17th century that was made in 1680s in France, and one side design actually looks like it could be a flying saucer flying in the clouds. It was released our web, and I can send you that link.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think it's pure speculation or coincidence, or what are your thoughts?
I looked at the pictures attached to it, and I'm telling you, man, it's got me wondering.
I'll have to check that out. Do you have the URL handy?
Yeah, I just sent it to you on IRC.
Okay.
It's www.prweb.com/releases/2005/1/PRWebXML202359.php.
That's a good candidate for tiny URL right there.
Yeah. But the puzzling UFO coin is quite puzzling if you look at it.
Let's see.
On that page, the top of the two images is the front of the coin, and on the bottom is the back. But the front of the coin, they have no idea what it depicts, but it certainly looks like a UFO to me.
You know, that does kind of look like a flying saucer of sorts. I can see that. Or some sort of flying mushroom or something. It's just, you know, why is this in the sky?
So it makes you just think that, you know, people haven't just been looking for UFOs in the past 100 years.
Okay. So on that interesting yet completely unrelated note, we have several interviews to look forward to this episode. So we're going to go ahead and add Kizzle, operator of the underground radio portal Hacker Media, onto the show.
Okay.
On the line with us now is Kizzle, the founder of the Hack Radio Portal website, hackermedia.net. Welcome to the Arts.
Hello.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the Hacker Media website, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, there are a lot of hacking, freaking, and even geek radio shows out there, and they're not very organized at all. So I made the website so that it's all in one spot. You don't have to load up 20 web pages each day to see what's new. And each show, the host of each show goes on the site and they post the news themselves. They post when there's new episodes out. So it's not a lot of work for me, and the site works a lot better that way. And that way you have a lot more current information about the scene.
Now, you first got your start actually with Hacker Radio itself, right?
Well, I started out on the short-lived show Hacksaw Radio, and I was on there for the first few episodes, I think till around episode 7. And once I was done with that, then I started Uber Lido. And that's just kind of a fun show I still run today. Not as much as I used to, but I put a show out maybe once a month. And it's just kind of a random kind of rant about what's going on. Sometimes I'll rant about the news, or sometimes it'll just be some sort of off-the-wall thing, or I'll interview somebody. It's just kind of whatever I want.
What was your main inspiration behind Hacker Media?
Well, back in the day, around 2000, there was a show by the people that ran Slashdot called Geeks in Space. And I first found that show, and I loved it. I'm more of a kind of a audiovisual kind of person, so hearing people talk is a lot more interesting to me than just reading things. And I ate that stuff up. I loved every episode. But after it was done, after they stopped doing the show, I was just kind of, I was lost. There wasn't any more out there. I tried searching and couldn't find anything. And then I found Radio Freak America, and that opened me up to seeing a lot of other shows, and there was just a bunch of these shows out there, but they're so unorganized that I started Hacker Media to put them all in one spot.
Right. I mean, before Hacker Media kind of resurged, a lot of people would just go out to, like, the BinRev forums and read those, pick through and see if there's anything new happening. But, you know, you kind of have to wade through a lot of different posts and texts in order to get to what you want, you know, the radio shows.
Exactly. I'd also like to mention, they've talked about possibly bringing back Geeks in Space. Mulda is making an appearance at LinuxConf in Boston coming up in, like, 2 weeks, and he's talked about possibly recording a couple of interviews there.
Wow, you just made my day. That's one of my all-time favorite shows. I would like to mention that it does make it a lot easier to keep track of the shows and that you're going to listen to a lot wider variety of stuff, because when you're trying to keep track of so many shows, it's like you kind of fall in a rut of only maybe caring about 3 shows because nobody's going to try to visit all these sites every day. But when it's all laid out for you, like every day you have a new show, it's a lot easier to just click that link.
When was Hacker Media initially founded?
Well, a couple of years back, I just registered the domain and it just sat there. I had a grand vision of organizing everybody, which I didn't do until recently. But, yeah, couple years ago, registered the domain, and it pretty much just sat there. Eventually, I started providing hosting for a few shows that were just starting out, just kind of small shows. I didn't want to pay for hosting, so that's what it did until about 6 months ago. It was just giving people some, just kind of helping shows out that may have just kind of fizzled out and not even started. Yeah, so about 6 months ago, the show or the site changed over to being the new site.
About how many shows would you say you host links to?
I don't keep track of really the number of shows exactly, but the number of users that can post is around 30. And sometimes there'll be somebody that will, they have a counter and they're posting their own shows, but they'll see something else that's interesting, maybe some sort of video they found or some random other show, and they'll post that too.
You're probably feeding for about, you know, roughly 30 underground radio shows. Would you say that's a fair estimate?
That's pretty good estimate.
Okay. So, yeah, recently, a few months ago, this whole podcasting thing has kind of taken the internet radio scene by storm, and that's something that Hacker Media has embraced. And so I was wondering, since every other underground radio show out there has already covered the subject of podcasting, I figure it's our turn. So could you tell everybody what podcasting is or how you would define that?
If anybody's familiar with news readers, with RSS feeds, it allows you to subscribe to a bunch of different news sources, and you can use a program to just show you what's going on every day. And it makes reading news a lot easier. Well, people use the same exact technology, just RSS feeds, and they just tweaked it a little bit. So now you use a podcasting program, and you just download shows automatically. It's kind of like TiVo for internet radio.
And you don't actually need an iPod to do podcasting.
Right,
that's a big misconception that I hope they'll eventually change the name over. Because, yeah, exactly, you do not need an iPod.
The name podcasting is very deceiving. Every single person that I come across and I say, hey, you really need to check out podcasting, the first thing out of their mouth is, well, I don't own an iPod. I don't own, you know, a personal music device or anything like that. And absolutely, you don't need one in order to take advantage of the podcasting technology, because basically all it does, like you said, is it's utilizing the RSS2 standard, which was originally used by news aggregators and such to pull news from like Slashdot or whatever news site you read, or Puet, or you know, pretty much anything, scene.org. Everybody supports RSS for news delivery. And so what they're doing now with podcasting is taking that standard and just taking advantage of the enclosure tag in the RSS standard and using that to deliver files. So kind of like the analogy that I like to give to people who are familiar with the old days of VBSing is that podcasting is basically like the AE line equivalent of an RSS feed. You know, it's the files only, whereas, you know, the traditional RSS feeds would be the text and the news and the headlines of what you'd ordinarily receive. As I said before, every scene site out there that publishes news carries an RSS feed today, you know, if they're worth their weight. There's a thread on Puet which has a huge list of different RSS feeds for text only, not for podcasting. That's thread 1174. And then for the underground podcast feeds, pretty much the place to go. There's a couple sites out there like, you know, Off the Hook and a few others and BinRev that have their own individual RSS feed. But Hacker Media is basically the epicenter of the internet radio scene right now.
And that web address is what?
Hackermedia.net.
What sort of publication tools are you using to create your RSS feeds on Hacker Media right now?
It's pretty dead simple. I use the WordPress. It's just blogging software. And people just post news posts just like you would post blog entries. And I use just a modification to it that somebody wrote, just a plugin, that right under where you're writing your post.
Yes.
And it gives you a little area to stick in your URL to your MP3.
Just to self-promote the arts for a minute here, the arts does have its own RSS, combined RSS and podcast feed, which is available at www.acid.org/radio/index.rss. And this can be read in a news aggregator such as FeedReader or a podcasting client such as iPodder. And to set this up, I mean, it's so dead simple. I literally type in that URL, I click add, and then I, you know, check the selected feed, and if there's anything new there, it'll automatically download, in this case, those MP3s to my machine. There's a couple different places. If you want to get a podcasting client, try it out. You can go to Podcast Alley. There's the direct URL for that is www.podcastalley.com/podcast_software.php. If you also just want to try out the news aggregation and grab a client for that, such as FeedReader or something else, you can go to blogspace.com/RSS/readers. Are there any podcasting clients that you prefer over another? Kizzle?
Not really. A lot of them seem to... There's the base one, just the original podcasting one, which is just... It's pretty simple. You put in the feed you want, and it grabs it. Beyond that, the ones that are more fully featured right now, it seems like they're kind of buggy, so I don't use them as much. I'm sure that's going to change. For now, I just kind of stick to the base one.
And as usual, the more features you add, the more bugs you add.
Exactly.
You know, outside of the, you know, the Hack Freak and Geek radio shows out there, are there any other radio shows that you listen to via podcasting?
The major one I'm listening to right now is Whole Wheat Radio. It has absolutely nothing to do with hacking or freaking, but there's just some people that live in Alaska in a little shack, and they do a podcast every day.
It's just life in Alaska, or what is it? What do they talk about?
It's pretty funny that, yeah, they talk about life in Alaska and that sort of thing.
Ice fishing?
No, the guy's actually kind of techie.
Yeah.
So he does talk about that sort of stuff to an extent.
If you lived in Alaska, you'd have plenty of free time to get techie, too.
Yes.
Alkamar, do you have any other questions?
No, I don't.
I do have one little thing I can add, is that I've noticed there is kind of a difference between the sort of people that do podcasts and do radio shows, because, I mean, there's a misconception that this internet radio thing is just starting. A lot of people think, oh, my God, podcasts, this is new. People are doing internet radio. No, it's been around since... 94, but there's a, when people do these podcasts, they do it more from a blogging mindset. So, for example, you'll see people that'll just do their show, and they won't keep archives, because why would you want to read old stuff? Just like a blog, why do you want to read the old blogs? So people really, they usually read the newest stuff. They talk about their life. A lot of people do diaries now with podcasting. No, actually, it's I have this. It's Geek of the Week was the first one. It was made in 93. No, I said 94. I meant 93. Is if you want to look at it, it's town.hall.org/radio/geek. And this was distributed via FTP back then in this .au format, I believe. You guys are probably more familiar with that audio format is. But
right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the first one.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, there was recently, I guess it was probably in October, there was an article written about how people were using the RSS enclosure tag, and somebody, you know, blessed it with the name podcasting, and ever since then, it's really been taking off. The scene is definitely changing as far as internet radio goes as a result of that.
Something about that whole pod name makes people go crazy. I don't know what it is.
Well, the iPod is so successful that anything with the name is just going to blow up.
Okay, well, actually, that is all the questions I have. Kizzle, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Just that this excites me that I think this is going to become a lot more mainstream. I think you're going to see services like Google has their blogging service, and everybody has a blogging service. I hope to see companies go and provide a blogging service where it's just a one-click thing. You go and record your show, and it gets posted on there, and there you go. I think the more this alternative media, the better.
Kizzle, once again, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
No problem.
Take care, bud.
Have a nice day.
Once again, that was the alternative media mogul Kizzle of HackerMedia.net. How's your phone battery?
My phone is doing just fine.
I'm always scared that the power is going to go out one day and I'll lose the whole fucking show.
Buy a UPS.
I have one. The battery died on it.
Oh, I just got a new battery for mine. It cost me $20 for a new battery for my rack mounter.
That's all it costs?
Yeah. If you go on eBay, you can find individual batteries. They always come uncharged. Just buy a bunch of the individual, like, 7-volt cells and daisy chain them together. It's the same thing as having a real battery. You can get them for a hell of a lot less, and then you just plug them all together with a daisy chain, throw them in your UPS, and wait for it to charge them up.
No shit.
Yeah, because APC won $140 for a brand-new battery for mine, and I spent $20 on a replacement.
That's awesome. In other news, DeviantArt has recently announced that they're going to be holding the DeviantArt Summit. Early on when the arts first started, we had one of the executives from DeviantArt, Spot, on our show. I believe it was episode 2. DeviantArt, as probably everybody knows, is the largest community of artists on the internet today. They're now approaching their 5th year in operation, and they're going to be holding a major convention of sorts this summer called the DeviantArt Summit. So the details on this particular event have been held pretty tightly under wraps, but we've been able to obtain some information from some trusted sources, and here's what they've divulged so far. We know that the DeviantArt Summit's going to be, it's scheduled to be held this summer, sometime in June. They're expecting a turnout of somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 visitors, and it's going to be held in a large airplane hangar in Santa Monica.
Cool. More details and to sign up to receive the DeviantArt Summit newsletter, I guess you can go to summit.deviantart.com.
What other headlines do we have? Legalize isn't dead. So sorry to all the sceners in Europe out there. Contrary to the rumors posted on the Scene Spot message boards, Legalize isn't dead. This month, Legalize finally posted the highly anticipated party release version of Le Fleurs by the Order of K, the winter demo at Pilgrimage 2004. It's definitely worth noting that this demo requires a video card with the NVIDIA chipset on it. It will not work with ATI graphics cards.
So get out your brand new GeForces and go to work.
Exactly. Phoenix of Hornet has been generous enough to upload and to capture, well, I'm not sure who captured it, but he's been generous enough to upload a video version of this demo in AVI format until the folks at K can put out a final version which supports both the ATI and the NVIDIA video cards out there. So both of those can be found, both the party version and the video captured versions of this demo can be found on Puet.net.
I hope they hurry up and get an ATI version out there. After all, they did win an ATI Radeon X800.
Yeah, I spoke with GZ a few months ago, and he's been working on it. Hopefully we'll see that soon. While on the subject of Puet, one of the most common complaints about Puet.net is that while it does carry arguably one of the most comprehensive databases of demo scene releases and such, you know, the message forums are just plagued by immaturity, useless posts, flames, and so on. And so,
sort of like Fark.
Yeah, yeah, kind of like Slashdot or, you know, 2CH or anything else, really. But, you know, so that's been a real problem or a real nuisance for a lot of people. So in response to this, Puet now supports a Firefox user script called the Attention Horse Toggle. And so this script was written by P01, and this allows you to specifically ignore posts by any particular user out there that you find annoying. And it seems to be quite effective. Let's see, I had the URL for that. I don't know what I did with it, but I think it was pretty, let me see here. Oh yeah, there it is. It's on P01's website. It's you can pretty much guess the URL. It's www.p01.org. You go there, you click on releases, Grease Monkey user scripts, and you'll see it right there. What else? We got some.
Also in the news, we have the German library allowed to crack copy protection. In order to fulfill its legal mandate to index and archive important German-based works, the Deutsche Bibliothek, Germany's national library, has been granted permission under law to crack copyright protection to preserve digital works.
I was reading about that on Slashdot. It sounds really similar to the interview that we had with Simon last episode, where he was talking about archive.org, and Brewster Kahle has been challenging a lot of the limitations under the DMCA. And it's good to hear that other countries are getting these issues resolved, because basically,
the U.S. has draconian copyright law.
Well, and I mean, in order to preserve all of this digital data out there, which is going to just fall by the wayside if we don't do anything about it.
And disappear if people don't get on the bandwagon.
Yeah. Exactly. And also just recently, archive.org has also filed a lawsuit appeal in the case Kahle versus Ashcroft, where he is challenging the constitutionality of the Copyright Renewal Act and the Copyright Term Extension Act. There's a major, major problem right now where when works have become out of print and the publisher cannot be found, yet the work is still under copyright, it presents a real big problem.
And sadly, we have Sonny Bono to thank for that. Well, it was the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act, so we really have him to thank.
This really does affect anyone who lives in the United States and people outside of our borders here. So if you want to follow this, if you want to check out the URL for this and follow the perversion of our copyright law, if that's your cup of tea, you can go to cyberlaw.stanford.edu/about/cases/KAHLE_V_ashcroft.shtml and check that out.
Archive.org also, for some of you Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans out there, they recently uploaded a full public domain version of Santa Claus versus the Martians, one of the very first movies the MST3K guys made fun of.
That is
actually
sweet.
Download the entire movie from archive.org.
You know, I can't say it enough how, you know, the tremendous amount of respect that I have for the people at the Internet Archive and Brewster Kahle. I mean, the guy receives billions of dollars from his sale of Alexa to Amazon. And what does he do with it? he takes that and creates this massive internet archive, and then fights all the completely, you know, like you said, draconian copyright laws out there. In other, perhaps more questionable news about copying material, last month on December 19th, 2004, supernova.org officially closed.
You should have seen the backlash when they shut down on IRC.
I wasn't following it on IRC. What did you witness there?
I was on their IRC server, and I think in the first hour after the notice was posted on the website, they must have had 7,000 users flood the channel asking, where can we go to get BitTorrents? So we've been passing them to other places, such as the Pirate Bay, which is based in Sweden, for about a month and a half now.
The Pirate Bay's website is www.thepiratebay.org. Not only do they have a huge selection of torrents, of, you know, different types of torrents ranging from audio, video, you know, movies, computer programs and such, they also have a nice little archive of legal threats from various film studios and software companies.
Which, and they're quite hysterical to read.
Yeah, because not only do they post the threats, they also post their own entertaining responses.
Also from the supernova.org folks, they've just recently gotten out their beta for Exim. I don't know if you folks have heard about that. Exim is supposed to be a peer-to-peer client, allows you to search for BitTorrent streams. You can find that at exim.com, that's E-X-E-E-M.com, for the official. And some folks have been complaining that they have a little bit of adware or spyware on there, so there's also a Exim Lite, which you can find at E-X-Lite, L-I-T-E.net.
That's pretty cool. So this is basically a peer-to-peer way to track torrents out there?
Pretty much.
What else? There's been some really neat software released recently. Picasa 2 has been released. It's basically a graphic software indexing tool and editing tool, I guess you could say, which was originally created by a company named Picasa, which Google later bought out. If you're familiar with the Google desktop and you're familiar with programs such as ACDC, Picasa 2 is basically the best of both of those worlds. So once you install it, it goes through and it seeks out throughout your entire hard drive and indexes and thumbnails every photo and video that it comes across. It's kind of like Google Desktop for your PC, but made for images and managing those images. The one little thing that I've noticed, it's not completely without flaws. It does seem to crash quite frequently after viewing motion video on my PC, so I've stopped using it for that purpose.
ACDC does the same thing whenever I'm browsing through a folder and come across a video file, so it's not common to just Picasa.
But yeah, in any case, it is, you know, it's completely free, it's very functional, and it's highly effective if you want to find an image once it's concluded indexing your system for, you know, images and graphics. It's very effective for finding a picture that you're looking for. If you want to download Picasa 2 and check it out, go over to blogger.hello.com and grab a copy of that.
Another noteworthy software package released recently was Trillion 3.0. It's a multi-chat program that's come a long way in the past few years. Trillion 3.0 supports all of the major chat clients, IRC, Yahoo Messenger, Microsoft's Messenger, AIM, and ICQ Instant Messengers. And the best part? There's no pop-ups. There's no spyware, and there's no spam. It supports encrypted messaging through AIM and ICQ, and the registered pro versions even support video chatting and animated emoticons. Other than that, the basic version is very full-featured, and for you AIM users, this allows you to get more people than you could normally have on your buddy list, too. You can download Trillion at CeruleanStudios.com. That's C-E-R-U-L-E-A-N Studios.com.
Yeah, definitely.
Go ahead and try it out.
Yeah, it's a great program. I'm using it now. I still use MIRC and BitJax on occasion, but for all of the other instant messenger programs, I've consolidated everything into Trillion, and it works great. I've had no problems with it. In fact, I think it works better. Like you said, there's no spyware, and there's no pop-ups, there's no advertising. In other news, Jurassic Pack Magazine issue 13 has been released recently. The Amiga Disk Mag Jurassic Pack released their 13th issue on December 20th, 2004. This issue features an article about the arts, which was written by Gandhi. So I just wanted to thank him and the rest of the staff for the kind words that they wrote about the show here. If you want to check out the Disk Mag, you can pick up a copy of JP13 from www.jurassicpack.de. It also contains instructions on how to set up and configure an Amiga emulator in order to experience the coded Disk Mag versus the HTML versions that they carry online.
And I would like to recommend, if you're looking for a good Amiga emulator, there's an Amiga emulator out there called Amiga Forever. I love it. It's wonderful. It works great.
How do you feel that stacks against WinUAE? I prefer to use WinUAE.
You know, it's a good toss-up. some things each one handles differently. Win works a lot better on some issues. Some of the video gets a really jumpy on Win, though, I think. And I think Amiga Forever is much more of an older Amiga stuff kind of setup.
Also, a couple of parties have taken place recently since our last Arts episode. TUM 2004, the ultimate meeting, took place right after Christmas, December 27th to 29th in Hemsbach, Germany. And they featured the unveiling of Farbrausch's version 2 of their sound synth and Pain Magazine issue 56, which was presented by Sir Garbage Truck. As a matter of fact, we have Sir Garbage Truck who's waiting for our call, so I thought we'd go ahead and add him in now, live from the UK. Okay, with us now is Sir Garbage Truck, live from the UK. Since his scene career in 1987, Truck has been a part of a great many groups, such as Twilight, LSD, Danish Gold, and currently Accession. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the Arts.
Thank you.
We'll just jump right into things. How did you get started in the scene, and what scene was that for you at the time when you joined?
Oh, well, back in 87 or so, I got my second computer, which was a C64. Before that, I had a Timex Sinclair 1000. When I turned 18, I was able to take money out of my bank account by myself. So I went across town with money from my bank account, got a C64, and came back home and pissed my dad off. At that point, it took about 2 or 3 months for me to actually discover any sort of scene at all, because I didn't have a modem. Once I saw a modem over at a friend's house, it occurred to me how much you could do by talking to people and sharing stuff that way. And that was really the start of it. Of course, it was all local for a number of years, really. Even when I got my Amiga, it was still pretty much local.
Local meaning?
So you remember, yeah, like one of the folks who freaked their way onto international boards?
No, I didn't touch freaking because by the time, as I said, I was 18.
Yeah.
So this put the threat of, oh, I'll be going to jail if I get caught into me.
When you say that you were dialing out to your, you know, your local scene, some of our listeners are, you know, we've just introduced you as Sir Garbage Truck in the UK, but you clearly have an American accent. Where were you calling?
I was in Akron, Ohio.
Okay.
And the local area at the time was the 216 area code. It was before it had split to 330.
Okay.
So even Cleveland was still somewhat local.
Yeah, I actually remember dialing into a Cleveland BBS at one point in time.
Which one was that, Bigfoot's or?
I think that was it. It's been years, so.
There were a couple really big Cleveland BBS's. Mainly PC-based, which in a way was kind of a bad thing because there were so few that catered to non-PC. Although you could find them, there were C64 boards back in the day that ran on C64s and still are, of course. People that actually had large amounts of storage in the States tended to be PC owners. And as such, they would discourage anything but small PC files because, quote-unquote, Amiga DMS images are too big, or I don't know why anybody would still be using a Commodore 64. But at one point I had to go out and buy a dual standard U.S. Robotics 14.4 modem that allowed me to actually start calling boards that would allow higher speeds. And at that point, I was starting to be able to get demos of my own.
At that point, you started operating a BBS? Is that right?
No. I'd been operating a BBS. We operated the Freeloom BBS in Ravenna/Kent, Ohio. It was a WWIV board, and there were four of us that ran it, four sysops. At the time, I was going by the handle mandibular joint dysfunction. The main guy behind it was a fellow by the name of God himself. He didn't actually want a handle, but we made him have one.
Right.
Then another person was second in command, and then finally the prisoner.
Now, this BBS was operated out of a graveyard, if I understand correctly?
Yeah, we lived in a graveyard. It cost us $75 a month to stay there. and all the money went into the upkeep of the place where we were living, which was fine until the roof caved in. That's another story.
Well, that's you've been called the biggest party stallion in the scene, period. In 2004, you attended many parties throughout Europe. How many parties in total did you attend, and what different countries did you visit as a result?
Okay. Who called me the biggest party stallion? Where did that come from? That has never been said to me, ever. Not to my face. I went to 9 parties last year, and I've already been to 1 this year. The 9 parties last year were Breakpoint, Symphony in Poland, MSX Coolers and Assembly, both in Finland, Bunsli in Switzerland, Evoke in Germany again, Kindergarten in Norway, and Function in Hungary, and then Tomb again in Germany, and then off to alt party this year for, Finland was alt party again this year.
Excellent. At the Ultimate Meeting 2004, you were the presenter of Pain Magazine issue 56. Were you elected to do this? Did you volunteer?
Unlock and Dipswitch came up to me and said, hey, it'd be really cool if you introduced Pain. And I said, okay. Unfortunately, one of the sceners who was actually at the party had an episode and ended up going to the hospital, so we delayed the presentation for a while. It was nothing serious. The individual in question had just stressed himself out a little bit too much, which, you know, is very odd. When you're at a party to relax and you stress yourself out, you might be doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Well, if you've got a presentation going on and things are not working, you can get quite stressed.
I believe they had 7 presentations.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. And basically, everybody told him, calm down. It'll work out.
Yeah, he needed some salmiakki.
We delayed it, and then, I went on stage. They showed the disc magazine interface behind me, and I commented on each one of the various top 10 lists. And if I could, I might mention, if you are voting for Pain, you might want to check and see if the people you're voting for are actually currently doing that. Uncle X was at Tomb, and he did point out that he hasn't done 3D graphics for 3 years and does not belong on the top 10 chart. On the other hand, Gargai says that he doesn't belong on the coding chart, and you should vote for Smash. To each his own.
Transitioning over, you're also one of the admins for Nectarine Radio. For those who have been missing out on Nectarine all this time, what is it?
Nectarine is a demo scene radio, There are others. Yes, of ScoopX. I believe at the time when it was first started, he was in Surprise Productions. But he formed a radio station based on a web interface which people could select the tunes that they wanted to hear and request them, and they'd be streamed. And they were all tunes from the demo scene, either demo parties, famous tracks from demos, or done by various famous demo scene artists. That's where we draw the line. People ask us all the time, okay, what do you mean by demo scene radio?
Right.
And what we, as the admins, have settled on as far as a definition is, demo scene radio is radio that plays music made by sceners. And thus we get the next question, okay, well, what's a scener? And sceners, of course, there are many, many different ways of defining them. What we say is, if you have an involvement with the demo scene in some way, if you are in the creative demo scene, creating demos, if you were in it at one point, and as long as you are not producing commercial works, it's fine. We can play it.
So you wouldn't be playing stuff like MC Hawking or Cyclop then?
No. MC Hawking would be an interesting thing, and various people in the Scene Music channel on IRCNet have enjoyed things like that, but no, that's not something from somebody involved with the demo scene. So if someone were to upload that, we would basically say, no, that doesn't quite qualify as scene music. In the same way, we've had a tremendous number of game remix tunes, especially from the C64, and we get these uploaded all the time. The problem is that there are so many of them, it threatens to drown out the focus of the demo scene that we try to keep to. Right. So as such, we've drawn a moratorium and said, look, we're not taking any more game tunes. And sometimes people get upset.
If a demo scene musician or tracker wanted to go about uploading a song to Nectarine Radio, what is the process for doing so?
Well, let me just say, wait a couple months. Currently, you upload the file to nectarine.scene.org. If you do that now, you're going to have to wait until probably March to see the tune added. That's the last time, I believe, that we'll be adding them from the FTP in bulk.
Okay.
And the process is you upload it there, the admins go through all the files, make sure that they're not commercial, make sure that they fit, make sure that they're encoded properly. It has to be encoded 128 kilobit MP3. And then at some point, when Yes has time, which is very precious, he is very, very busy, he will take the files off the FTP site and put them into the database, and then they will be available for requests.
I sadly noticed the other day I went looking for the old Cosmic Free music stuff, and I noticed their site is down. Do you guys happen to have a lot of their old stuff or anything like that?
I have some of it. The person you want to go to for that is Phoenix of Hornet. He would actually, and I've been tracing him up somewhat on it, he may have some links for it. We have several of the tracks that were from there, especially the tracks that were played on an earlier radio station, which was based on Real Media, called Loud Factory, which was out of Canada. But we don't have all of them. So, yeah, a lot of the U.S. tracker scene, Cosmic Free Music Foundation, Molotov Bliss.
Which track was it, Alcavar, I'm sorry, that you're looking for?
Just most of the old stuff in general. I mean, I lost my CD that had a copy of their whole site, and I was just looking to rebuild some of those, so I was wondering if they had any.
Yeah, we have some of them, and that's the thing. We constantly are constantly getting new tracks, either from the early Amiga days, early C64 days. There's a lot of stuff that's uploaded from the Atari scene, which I was not familiar with prior to this. And I always thought that the YM chip was just incapable of producing good sound. But if you've got a good musician like Jessup Outlanders or Choo Choo Rocket, it doesn't matter. They're good tracks. They're good tunes. The fact that the synthesizer isn't very good doesn't matter. You get a lot of interesting, varied stuff on Nectarine. We try to, again, keep it straight to the core, meaning that it's related to the demo scene in some way. We have another policy at on Nectarine, which is we don't delete stuff once it's been uploaded. I don't care if you don't like the track. It doesn't mean that everybody else doesn't like the track. Just because you happen to like a particular genre of music doesn't mean that the rest of the world needs to cater to that.
And Nectarine itself started like sometime in like early to what, mid-2000 or...
It started on March 1st, 2000.
Okay.
So you have an anniversary coming up then?
We have a 5-year anniversary coming up, and at that point there will be a number of changes to Nectarine. Yes has been working on a new CSS-based layout with no tables that is skinnable, and he has created several skins for an Amiga, C64, and Atari. I believe there's even a PC ANSI skin. And there will also be a new upload system, which Doe of Dream Dealers has created. And it's Java-based, so not everyone will be able to use it, but most everyone will. And those that won't will work something out. You will go and you'll upload the file directly to the database. And then the admins will be able to listen to it there, and they'll either be able to approve or disapprove, and then it'll go right into the playlist. So there won't be this waiting that we've had before, waiting for Yes to get a few minutes free from work to be able to download 300 tunes and upload them.
So that'll help streamline the upload process significantly, it sounds like.
Let's get away from Nectarine for a moment and get back to you. Some of our listeners don't know how you got the name Sir Garbage Truck. Could you tell them?
Yeah, somebody gave it to me. I honestly do not remember anything more than that. I remember Mub was telling us we were. See, I'd had a number of handles before that, and I was looking for a new one, and I was working in the trucking industry at the time, and I just threw out Sir Garbage Truck, and Mub said, "Yeah, that'll work," and it stuck. Not very exciting, but hey, I've kept it ever since.
Alkavar, going back to how you were asking about, you know, where can I find a certain mod? There's a really great site, really great resource that I wanted to bring up that's operated by Cato here in the U.S. and it's a low bandwidth site, so you know, don't hammer it too hard. But it's kmods.dynedns.org/mods, and they have a huge, extensive collection of music that most other archives don't have, and it'd actually be nice to see some of this stuff ported over to scene.org and maybe even filtered into Nectarine sometime down the road.
Difficulty you have with that is that sometimes you get into the areas. We had a discussion on Poet a couple weeks ago. I believe Reed Fairlight posted it, and it brings up the differences that sometimes you get between people who are acclimated to understanding the scene is a global thing and encompasses everything that wants to be a part, and the people who say, oh, well, I'm being excluded. Sometimes some of the people on the outskirts and the fringes don't want to be included. They say they want to be included, but the minute that you tell them that they're going to be included with things, then they start throwing up walls and barriers. And they pretend that they're not being included. And as a result, you run into these problems where you start adding people. We've had this on Nectarine. Somebody will upload a tune, and somebody will tell you, I don't want my tune there. I don't want Scene.org, or I don't want the demo scene to be surrounding my work. I'm not part of that. And I don't know why anybody would do that, but there are people who do. So that's something you got to take into mind. You got to look at the artist. What does the artist want to be associated with? They are the artist's tracks, and they ought to have the control over where they go.
One final question.
Yep.
Bass. What does it mean to you?
What does?
Bass.
What does scene mean to me?
No, bass.
Oh, bass. All I can say is be at Breakpoint 2005, and you'll see.
All right. Well, thank you, Truck, for your time. This has been a really great interview. If you'd like to learn more about the mystery behind the truck, Sir Garbage Truck has also been interviewed at length in Scene Zine Issue 5, their August 2003 issue, which can be found on the Scene Zine site at scenerep.org. Thank you once again, Truck, for being on the Arts.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Have a nice day, man.
Take care, dude.
That's it.
What else has been happening? The results to the Text Mode Demo Contest 7 have recently been published.
They were announced at All Party 6 in Finland, and we've mentioned TMDC before in Arts Episode 8 and 9. The competition ran really close, but the winner was a demo, Rivulet, by the North American demo group Trailer Park Demos. In an extremely close second, though, was Dead Blue People by Traction, and there was also an interesting demo which did RGB color faking in ASCII, which needs to be checked out, called Fixed by Kaleido.
Yes, they released a party version and a final version, so I thought it was pretty amazing, actually, you know, that somebody decided to basically do color faking in text mode. I was pretty impressed, but they also released a version which is a little bit more normal, so you don't have to stand 10 feet away to see it. Both of them are good, so you can check out the final version or the party version. Rivulet was really great. It had a classical score behind it and a really nice closing ANSI screen by Unseen. And Dead Blue People by Traction was amazing. It had a very catchy song. the two were really neck and neck. I mean, it was really a fraction of a percent between Rivulet and Dead Blue People.
And it's always nice to see American groups winning over in Europe anyway.
Rivulet was a really, I guess, original text mode demo. You know, it wasn't the standard, basically. A lot of the text mode demos out there, they look as if they are regular demos just passing through an ASCII art filter or something like that. Rivulet didn't have that. So I think that's probably one of the things that really helped it achieve first place. Also, the ANSI screen by Unseen probably helped out a lot. I mean, as we saw last year at Text Mode Demo Contest 6, the winning text mode demo from that was the one by Brightlight and Antichrist. And Antichrist had a great closing screen ANSI in there as well, featuring a picture of, you know, Mr. T. So, you know, there might be something to be said there for that as well, but regardless, even without that closing screen ANSI, Bolognese was an amazing text mode demo, and it still is. It's one of my favorites. But yeah, definitely check these out. You can check them all out at www.taat.fi/TMDC. Another thing on the horizon is there's another demo scene book that should be coming out sometime in the near future called Freaks, written by the Hungarian demo scener Tomcat. This book is expected to be somewhere between 300 to 350 pages, with an expected retail price of 30 euros or 37 US dollars. I was speaking with Tomcat about this just last night, actually. The majority of the research and writing has been done by Tomcat, but there are three chapters written by people such as Gene of Chromance, Weasel of Padua, and Trickster of Hornet. And there's also several Dismag articles and interviews written by many different known sceners. Apparently, though, right now, Tomcat is in need of some sort of a financial sponsor of sorts in order to publish this book. So if you're in a position to assist him financially or would like to make an investment in the publishing of this book or would like more information on the book, check out the Freaks website. Their website is www.freax.hu. I know all of us would really like to see this book come out. Okay, we're going to go now to an interview with Deathbase. He is the creator of Havoc Radio, one of the very first demo scene radio shows, talk radio shows ever to be created, and we'll go to that now. Okay, we're now speaking with Deathbase from the UK. Deathbase is a former member of the Amiga Group's Faction and Ram Jam, but perhaps most famously known for his creation of the first demo scene radio show, Havoc Radio. Welcome to the arts.
Thanks very much.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with Havoc Radio, what was it?
Well, it was basically, it was the first live, and I think it's the only live demo scene radio show. Back in about 2000, 2001, the only demo scene radio show that was out was Nectarine, broadcast by Mojuice, yes, of Orange Juice. That, as I'm sure everybody knows, is literally just 24-hour music. It lines up Shoutcast stream through a Winamp list, effectively, and just broadcasts it. What we did with Havoc Radio was incorporate everything that you would hear on a normal radio station as if you listen to FM radio. So we had news, we had interviews, we had live phone-ins from sceners around the world, we had music, we had party reports. And basically, it gave everybody an opportunity to listen in on the show and to find out exactly what was going on in the scene, to get the views and to hear sceners around Europe mainly, but to hear them give their views and their thoughts on the scene today and on issues that were going on.
How was Havoc Radio recorded and what methods were used to deliver it?
Right, this is an interesting question. For any of your listeners that haven't listened to any of our shows, we had a nightmare with setting the whole thing up. Basically, back in 2000, when the show was first thought of and when we started getting everything together, Shoutcast had only been around for, say, about a year. Shoutcast, for anybody that doesn't know, is obviously the live streaming system that lets you stream MP3s and live radio across the net, and it was created by Nullsoft, same people that did Winamp. Shoutcast was only just invented, and the things that we were trying to do, it just did not support. You basically had a Winamp playlist, you connected to your Shoutcast server, and that was it. That was all you could do. That was fine for people like Yes of Orange Juice when he was broadcasting Nectarine, because it was just static mods and MP3s. What we were doing was live interviews, live shows, incorporating pre-recorded spots from people like ADOC of Huggy, Sulfur of CFX Web, and we were mixing that all in together and including in that live phone-ins. That was IP phone and normal phone, as well as people in the studio and a whole set of playlists. So what we actually ended up with was a setup of four PCs running different pieces of software. We had two running Winamp, one providing the Shoutcast stream, the other running the Winamp playlist, which was our segments, our spots, and the music. We had another that was running the disc writer system through Cool Edit, which recorded our entire show to disc so that we could upload it to the website for people to listen to later. And the last machine we used for the live phone-ins and for managing the IRC channels. So we do that through NetMeeting and other voice over IP software, basically. We then broadcast that through to some Shoutcast servers. Originally, Allodox ran our Shoutcast servers from a server in the Netherlands. When he was unable to carry that on, redhandofscene.org kindly took up the challenge, as it were, and he created some Shoutcast servers for us to stream to as well.
That's very impressive, yet convoluted, but very impressive.
As I say, the main problem was back then there just simply wasn't the software to do what we wanted to do, and the setup that we had to do was just ridiculous. And that's why if you listen to the shows, you'll hear our hardware failing all the time. Microphones turned off, just things didn't work, Winamp playlists stopped working. It was just a complete nightmare.
And Winamp's line and plugin was always a big, broken mess.
Yeah, it was just a total nightmare. And, of course, I was trying to do all this as well as host the show and get everything lined up at the same time. So we had a lot of fun. It was fun. Not very professional, but it was fun.
When did Havoc Radio first air? When was the first episode released?
Well, we did our first pre-release broadcast in December of 2000. That was just recorded to an MP3. It was an offline thing. I basically did a very short segment, a little bit of music, a little bit of introductions, a little bit of news, just to give people an understanding of what we were trying to do. Because everybody that I talked to through IRC on the boards and whatnot just didn't understand what we were trying to do. That was the first broadcast. It was an offline system. That was I think that was on the 19th of December in 2000. The first live show was about the 13th of January 2001, and that was proper Shoutcast for live listeners.
How long did Havoc Radio end up running for?
About 6 or 7 months in total. We did a good schedule of two shows a month, so one show every 2 weeks, and that went through all the way to June, July of 2001.
Speaking as somebody who recognizes the struggle in putting out a show even once a month, it's very impressive that you managed to do two shows a month, especially with the technical limitations that you were enduring at the time.
Yeah, thanks very much. I have to say, a lot of it was down to the rest of the Havoc team. People like Clary and Fury, who were recording segments for us. People like ADOC, who did the scene news. It was absolutely essential. Just preparing those shows took me a fair amount of time each week just to figure out what I was going to say. Our shows were about two and a half hours long, so I had to find the music for that. I had to find the news. Without other people giving their contributions, it just would never have happened. So the Havoc Radio wasn't just me. There were a whole load of people out there, too many to name, but Clary, Fury, ADOC, Mackay, Sulphur, lots of people.
Were they all from the UK?
No, not all of them. The guests that we had in the studio, Randall, Drift, and Mr. Tickle, they're all UK sceners. Mr. Tickle's a well-known Amiga scener. The rest of our guys, obviously, they couldn't travel to the UK. So Clary and Fury, Clary's from France, Fury is from Sweden or the Netherlands, I think. Switzerland, I think he's from. ADOC's from Germany, obviously, ADOC of Huggy. Sulphur is from the UK. We had Mackay, who's from Sweden, and Allodox and Redhand, obviously, Sing.org, and our Shoutcast servers were hosted in the Netherlands.
Throughout the 12 episodes that were eventually aired, did you have any episode that was a particular favorite of yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got two favorites. An entire episode that was my favorite was the Mecha Symposium broadcast. During that show, what I actually arranged for was for the Havoc team to go over to Mecha Symposium and go around and find all the real well-known sceners, sit down, interview them, talk to them, get their thoughts and get their views. And instead of the normal show format, which was normally my introduction, then some music, then some scene news, then another spot and some more music, I handed over the show completely to these recorded interviews that were done at Mecha Symposium. At the time, we just thought that was a really cool thing to do, because a lot of people couldn't get to parties, hadn't been to parties, wanted to know what was going on. And this was the first time. This was way before Assembly TV and Assembly Radio. And people just wanted to know what was going on at a party. They wanted to know these people's views. And we're talking, the interviews were done with people like Scoopix, Faith, TRSI, the real big names, Gandhi. These are the real giants of the scene. And it let a lot of people understand something more. I don't know the best way to explain this, but when you're talking on an IRC channel, when you're reading, you know, release notes, when you're reading file ID dizzes, you don't get a real feeling for what a lot of these guys did, what they felt, what they thought of. And the interviews were one real way to do it. But something that really brought that home to me not so long ago was a good Cena friend of mine, a mega Cena friend called Etrigan. He unfortunately died at the end of last year. And it just made me think that, obviously, the majority of the scene is getting older as the years go by, and we're not all going to be around for a long time. And with movements like the Demo Scene Outreach Group that Theon is doing and Frank Mithley, these things are introducing a wider population, if you like, you know, the people out there to the demo scene. But a lot of the real demo scene greats have left the scene, have died, have just become uncontactable, and being able to record these guys' thoughts, something that we can talk about, is a really, really important thing. And going along those lines, another show that we did was with Vention of Kefrins. Now, any of you listeners that know anything about Amiga demos will know Kefrins were the big group. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, they were the Amiga scene group to watch out for. Desert Dream was one of the greatest Amiga demos of all time. And I managed to get Vention of Kefrins onto the show to have a chat with him about his role in Desert Dream and about his thoughts on the Amiga scene. And it's just things like that that really brought it home to me recently, in fact, how important these things are. Those are my favourite shows.
If you don't mind filling in our listeners who aren't completely familiar with you, when did you first get into the demo scene?
Right. I first heard about the scene, as it were, back in the late 80s. That was when I got my first Amiga. That was when I started messing around, seeing what was going on, as everyone did back then. I found, in Amiga format, which is a now defunct magazine that you don't get anymore, but it was the Amiga magazine. There used to be adverts for PD companies. This is something you don't see anymore. The internet has totally killed PD companies. Basically, PD stands for public domain. These companies were just run by people out of their back bedrooms. What they do, you pay them a couple of pounds or a couple of dollars or whatnot, and they would send you floppy disks with the latest demos on, with the utilities on and whatnot. This is where all the utility discs came from, and I can't remember the name of the really popular one. It was not the Silence, but name escapes me from now on. But that's where these discs came from. You used to send these guys some money, they'd send you the discs, and you'd get to watch the demos. Obviously, back before the internet, you just had no way to get hold of these things. I got into the scene looking at these kind of things. I was interested. And then the very late 80s, about 89, I got my first modem. Started calling up scene boards, and from then on, I just got more and more involved in the scene.
Havoc Radio was actually, you eventually established a bulletin board system of your own, which was called Havoc BBS, and that was basically how you gave Havoc Radio its name, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I opened the Havoc, the bulletin board, I don't know now, probably in about 93, maybe, 92, 93. It was an Ami Express board, an Amiga scene board. And yeah, that's where the name came from. We ran Havoc from about 93 to about 98. And if my memory serves, we closed after about 65,000 calls over the period of about 5 years. And that's where the Havoc name came from. So it's not a name, it's a brand now.
For people who are interested and they want to check out some of the past archived episodes or shows from Havoc Radio, where can they go to download those?
You can go to www.thehavoc.co.uk. There's a Havoc Net Radio link on there. Most of the shows are online, and I know I've been really bad about this. I will try and get the rest of the scene, rest of the shows online as well for people to download. And also, we were talking about somewhere else that we could host them.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very interested in helping you mirror those shows if bandwidth is a concern or an issue at all. Acid would be glad, more than happy to host those. And I also know that Jason Scott of TextFiles.com would love to host those on his own website, audio.textfiles.com.
That's great. Thanks very much. I'll take the opportunity as well to say a big thanks to Redhound of scene.org. If anybody has got any spare cash at all, they should go to scene.org and donate some money to him. Scene.org really is the biggest scene resource, and it's very, very important to us. So give Red Hand some money or your support, because he definitely deserves it.
That basically, that wraps up all the questions. Deathbase, thank you very much for being on the show. It was a very informative interview, and I definitely learned a lot about Havoc Radio.
That's great. Thanks for having me on your show.
And once again, that was Deathbase of the now late Havoc Radio.
It would appear ICE has just released another art pack today. You can pick that up at the regular sources, which is www.ice.org.
Really? Are you on the ICE frozen delivery? Do you have the ICE frozen delivery RSS feed?
No, I do not. I just mentioned that because I see they've changed the topic in their IRC channel. And currently it seems their website is temporarily offline while they're uploading the pack. So.
Yeah, but exactly. I'm getting the connecting to ice.org, and it's just, it looks like my browser's frozen. All right, dude, forget it. It's lost on everybody, dude. All right. Lastly, I want to bring up the Japanese demo party, which is called the 2CH Party, hosted by folks such as Mr. 42 from the infamous 2CH.net or Nichanaru Web BBS in Japan. They've been organizing online 2CH demo parties since 2001. And this year, they're going to be holding a 64 kilobyte and a full unrestrained, as they call it, demo competition for 2CH Party 2005. Are you familiar at all with Nichanaru or the 2CH, you know, the 2CH web board or...
Sadly, I'm not.
Yeah, Nichanaru has really been a site of great interest to me. Just the, you know, the whole, they're like basically the epicenter of Japanese ASCII art, and they're also, you know, taking an interest in the demo scene. So they've also
I have actually seen some of the stuff over there. It's a definite unique style compared to Western ASCII.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
They incorporate the katakana characters, and it's phenomenal, the artwork that they're able to produce with the Shift.js character set. And if you go to the 2CH Party website, 2chparty.net, you'll even see a couple hints of that, you know, that 2CH style of Japanese ASCII art there. The deadline, if you'd like to contribute an entry to the 2CH Party, is this month, is the end of this month, January 31st, 2005. Once again,
so that doesn't leave you a whole lot of time, folks.
No, yeah. If you don't have anything already in the works, it's probably too late. You know, it seemed, you know, from my discussions with Mr. 42, it seemed like the Japanese scene is still starting to, you know, get rolling. So it's still rather small. So, you know, I'm sure that they'd be interested in any sort of entries from anybody from any part of the world. And I hope to maybe in the future possibly have one of the organizers from 2CH Party on the show by way of a translator.
That would definitely be nice. Sadly, I don't speak Japanese.
Yeah, I do have a few friends that do speak Japanese, so there is a possibility that we might be able to work something out. We'll see how that goes.
Just since you've been mentioning Japanese, is there a Chinese scene at all?
Not that I'm aware of. I've heard that there's Korean ASCII art. I haven't heard of anything that uses specific Chinese characters.
Because I know a lot of folks in the demo scene are very fuck the system, shall we say.
Yeah.
So it'd be rather interesting to see what they could get away with in China.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see it. I'm interested in all sorts of different text mode art. As a matter of fact, just this week, I decided to take the initiative to restart a new text mode demo archive. So I'm going to be putting up here very shortly a text mode demo archive. And so far, I've collected, is it 120 megabytes or 120 files? It's a pretty good number. Let me just take a quick look here. Yeah, well over 120 files so far that I've collected that are basically text mode demos. The majority of them are PC-based. A small handful are for the Commodore 64, the Amiga, and the Atari. But Saul used to maintain an archive, a text mode demo archive as well, and I believe he might be bringing that back. So that would be nice to see, and then we'll kind of share the releases that we have and breathe a little bit more life into that. What else has been going on in any of the scenes that you're involved or affiliated with?
Well, mostly, sadly, I haven't really had a whole lot of time to be participating in the online scene world. Most of the scene I've been involved in lately has been the rave scene. A couple of gigs coming up. I'm a DJ, for those who are unaware. I can plug my website here if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
www.alkivar.com. That's A-L-K-I-V-A-R.com. I've got a gig coming up in February if you're in the New England area.
What kind of what's the venue that you're going to be spinning at?
The venue I am performing at is an underground warehouse at the moment. They haven't officially given me the street address yet, so
It's pretty
back to the old school.
Yeah, that's pretty underground if you don't know the location.
Yes.
That's awesome. I think that pretty much wraps up our show this episode. This has been Arts Episode 10. Thank you, Alcavar, very much for filling in as a co-host this episode.
You're quite welcome, Redman.
Closing out this show is an excerpt from DJ Baby Ann's On the Dance Floor from her 2002 album, I'm About to Break. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.